From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. Welcome, Shayna and Steve.
Hi, Kim.
Good to be here.
Well, here are the issues. U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin met face-to-face for the first time in Geneva after weeks of buildup. Both sides have been underscoring opportunities for cooperation despite tense relations between Moscow and Washington. The 30 member states of NATO reaffirmed their military alliance at a summit in Brussels, along with a strong statement against Russia and, to a lesser degree, China. President Biden released what he described as the first ever national plan to combat domestic terrorism. A U.S. House panel said that documents obtained from the U.S. Department of Justice detail efforts by then President Donald Trump and his allies to pressure the department to change the 2020 presidential election result. The documents come as U.S. lawmakers investigate the January 6th deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol building by pro-Trump supporters. California lifted most of its COVID-19 restrictions as part of a grand reopening in which the state will end capacity limits, social distancing, and mask requirements for those vaccinated. In our final topic, the U.S. Senate unanimously passed a resolution establishing June 19th as Juneteenth National Independence Day, a U.S. holiday commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. Well, those are the issues and topics, and let's get started. Shayna, I will start with you. How significant was it for President Biden to meet with Putin at this point in his presidency?
Well, it is early on in the presidency, and clearly Biden felt it was important to have this meeting early on. And of course, it comes after meetings with other world leaders, the G7 in England and NATO leaders in Brussels, sort of gearing up for this big meeting with Putin in Geneva. But the Biden administration set the bar pretty low coming into this meeting. They didn't expect to change Russia's mind or to get Russia to promise anything right now. It was really to lay out America's grievances in a clear way. It's a laundry list from cyber attacks to Ukraine to human rights abuses. And to be really clear with Russia, where America stands and what America might do if Russia continues to act the way it's acting. But Biden also told reporters he didn't threaten Putin. The way he seems to have framed it, and of course we weren't in the room, but the way he seems to have framed it is that it's in Russia's best interest to comply with international norms. For instance, if Russia continues to harass American business people, then its trade status won't improve and companies won't want to invest in Russia. Or, for instance, Alexei Navalny, the opposition figure who's sick and in prison in Russia, if he dies, Russia's standing in the world will only drop further. There were, however, some concrete things to come out of this meeting. New talks have been launched on arms control, a promise by both sides to reinstate their ambassadors to their post. But Biden, at the end of the day, said the proof is in the pudding. The relationship with the United States will only change if Russia changes its behavior. And that's something we're going to have to see in the coming months.
And Steve, what would you say the next step is for this relationship between the U.S. and Russia, especially in light of pending sanctions from the U.S. against Russia?
The next steps were kind of outlined in both leaders' press conferences. It looks like they're going to get together and have some people from both sides look at cybersecurity. And Biden gave Putin a list of 16 entities that should be off limits to any kind of cyber attacks. And I found that it was positive that Putin seemed to have led with that in his post-summit press conference and put that up high in what has been accomplished along with the return of the ambassadors to each capital. And I think those are going to be the first steps, as well as actually getting some people from both sides to sit down and look at the issues that are between them that could cause a conflict and try to reduce those non-military incidents that could escalate into some sort of clash. The bar was set very low, and it seems that the summit succeeded by meeting those low expectations.
Also, we pretty much have been reporting on the many different issues that the U.S. and Russia do not agree on. Were there some areas that stood out where they did agree? I think, Shayna, you mentioned a couple of those, but what are some of the main issues?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say Number one, and as I mentioned before, both sides promising there will be further talks on this, is on arms control. It's in the interest of both countries to see nuclear stability and, in general, a capping increased arms production. I think the other issue that's important to both sides is fighting the pandemic globally and getting more vaccines out to people. I'm sort of taking the long view, though, of this meeting, because Putin has been in power for 20 years, and he's encountered a string of American presidents in that time. Bush the second famously said that he stared into Putin's eyes and saw his soul. And Hillary Clinton brought out a prop when she was as Secretary of State for President Obama. She brought out this reset button that she gave to the Russians that was widely mocked. And then you had Trump, who was overly flattering and very solicitous to Putin and siding with him publicly on the election meddling issue. So you have seen American presidents try to reset relations with Russia. Biden's approach seems to be, although he has called Putin a killer in the past, coming into this meeting, it seemed to be to keep things civil, set the bar low, as Steve pointed out, try to really sort of make the relationship less hostile than it already is. But again, this will be determined based on Russia's actions.
I also felt that Putin kind of took the opportunity to speak to really try to push back on what's going on in the U.S. When asked about Russia's crackdown on political dissent and the Navalny issue and human rights, Putin deflected and tried to create some sort of moral equivalence by raising the problems that the United States has, pointing to the killing of George Floyd and the mistreatment of Black people, the continued use of Guantanamo Bay to house and jail captured terrorists, as well as he made a point of using the January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol. Putin said, while recognize that we was here in Russia, to not allow that to happen. And Putin took the opportunity to try to show that Russia is not the only one with problems, and that the United States, in his mind, does things that are, in Russia's perspective, equally as bad as what Russia does.
Kim, if I can just piggyback off of Steve's answer for a minute. Like Steve mentioned, it's sort of Putin's go-to strategy, which is whataboutism. You think Russia is bad, look what you're doing. And it's also important to remember that Putin is not only speaking to the Americans in this meeting, he's speaking to the Russians, to the domestic audience, because Russia's heading into another election season, and Putin, who has been in power for 20 years, wants to continue to convince people there that he needs to stay in power indefinitely. And the best way to do that for an autocrat is to create this big, bad external enemy, which is the United States in this case. It's a tricky sort of situation here, but it's important to keep that in mind, that he's not only talking to the U.S. here at this meeting and in the press conference he had to reporters, but also to people back at home.
That is a very good point. And I also wanted to touch on the meeting with NATO members, where President Biden talked about the strength of NATO at a press conference in Brussels after the summit. And he also said that America is back. So, Steve, what was he referring to in this reference?
He was referring to the previous president's disdain for the NATO alliance and alliances in general. He tried to convince NATO leaders that the U.S. was back as a faithful ally, but it seemed that the NATO allies and the NATO leaders, while embracing the United States, glad you're back, they also understand that there's another election in 3 years and do not want to see the kind of whiplash that has occurred over the past 4 or 5 years, where the United States has gone from a strong NATO ally to one that is demanding that the allies pay their fair share, and with a president that deferred to what President Putin had said rather than try to make the United States position. So NATO allies are a little bit wary. Biden went there mostly to just try to shore up and give NATO allies confidence that the United States was back, but also show that NATO is in danger if they don't pay attention to what China is doing. And Biden succeeded in getting NATO to acknowledge that China's stated ambitions and behavior present systematic challenges to NATO and the rest of the international order. And I think that was a big win for Biden at NATO, and it got them to understand that Russia, which is closer and right on their doorstep, isn't the only nation that has to be watched.
That brings me up to my next question. Are Russia and China NATO's biggest challenges presently?
It is a good question. And as Steve mentioned, obviously NATO traditional main sort of adversary and the country it's been keeping an eye on is Russia. But for Biden, China is the much bigger sort of strategic global threat. And you saw that in his meetings with world leaders, both with the G7 and with NATO as well. And he did get some results there. The G7 put out a highly critical statement of China, far more critical than we have seen from that group in previous years. Critical from everything from China's human rights abuses to the crackdown in Hong Kong to not being transparent about the origins of COVID. And NATO, too, as Steve mentioned, they put out a statement really for the first time mentioning China. What was always interesting to me is that Trump really did everything he could to alienate the Europeans and NATO. And there was some valid criticism there, especially when it came to NATO, that members weren't paying their fair share, something that Obama complained about as well. But Biden seemed to come into these meetings really trying to focus on getting the alliances strong again, because he realizes that the best way to confront China is to show this united front. And so it was always sort of puzzling to me that Trump, who took this really hard line on China, pushed away these really important allies when he needed them the most. And you can see that Biden is trying to do something very different here and trying to get these allies on board in his sort of strategy to confront China.
Yes, and now let's take a look at in the U.S., one of the big focuses of the Biden administration is on reducing domestic terrorism. And they have a broad new strategy where they're seeking more funds for the Justice Department and the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Steve, how much of a threat is domestic terrorism today? Some studies are showing that I've been looking at that it has been increasing.
The FBI director said the number of domestic terrorism cases increased 30% in 2020. The main impact of what Biden is doing as far as raising domestic terrorism as an issue is using his bully pulpit to show that this is an important issue, and also to try and move the government's efforts on counterterrorism, which has been focused overseas, especially against militant Islamic terrorism since the 9/11 attacks, move that focus from the foreign terror threat to including the domestic terror threat, and really trying to get to the reasons for it, understanding the reasons for it, and coordinating the government across all agencies to deal with the domestic terror threat.
Also, Shana, the Biden administration conducted a sweeping assessment earlier this year of domestic terrorism that labeled white supremacist and militia groups as the top national security threats. So what types of changes do you see Biden is hoping to make with this new strategy?
First and foremost, by putting this out, it shows that this is a priority, this first ever national plan to combat extremism, domestic extremism. It shows that it's a priority for the Biden administration. It is important to note that this historic rise in domestic extremism, it's not only coming from white supremacists. There has been a surge in attacks from both white supremacists and far left groups, too, although the vast majority of those attacks are coming from extreme right groups. But in general, we're just seeing heightened violence from both sides, although it is, again, much more from extreme right wing groups, as you mentioned, really culminating in the Capitol attack on January 6th, which was an attack involving extremist right wing groups. The Biden administration's plan has sort of four pillars. It involves sharing information between law enforcement agencies, working with tech companies to try and stop online recruitment. So much of this is sort of fueled by what's going on online and the sharing of the conspiracy theories. It's also allocating funds to local organizations to combat this issue, trying to weed out violent extremists from the military. And it's all very complicated, especially to police this online. We've heard this from top law enforcement officials, because how do you know if someone is just venting and trying to sound tough, or if they actually mean what they say and they are planning to carry out an attack? And then, of course, you have the issue of civil liberties. We're talking about Americans here, not foreigners. And civil liberty advocates always get really nervous that innocent Americans' rights might be trampled. And who's to say there might be another president that comes next who decides that really a non-threatening group are terrorists and goes after them? So it can be a slippery slope here, but it's also very much a problem that needs to be addressed. It's a growing problem that needs to be addressed.
The Attorney General, in talking about the domestic terror threat, made the point that the government wants to deal with the violence that the domestic terror threat poses and not get into ideology. And that, as Shana mentioned, that's a fine line to walk when you're seeing various different threats in words, in messages, but try to then move to stop whatever violence that could come out of it, it could create a situation where ideology is being trampled and people's beliefs are being trampled. And that's contrary to the First Amendment in the United States. So it is a really difficult issue for our government to deal with. The January 6th attack on the Capitol, the hearings that have come out and the information that has come out show a woeful lack of coordination between various different law enforcement agencies. And I think the national strategy is designed to try and reduce those holes and make sure that one agency is talking to the other agency and that a third agency knows what everybody else knows and sharing information across various different government agencies and platforms.
You all have raised some really good points on this issue. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, new documents detail how Donald Trump, as president, pressured the U.S. Justice Department to challenge the 2020 election. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panelists who are joining me via Skype, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. Well, Shayna, emails released by the Democrats on the House Oversight Committee appears to paint a clearer picture of how former President Donald Trump and his allies attempted to pressure the U.S. Justice Department to investigate unsubstantiated claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election. So how significant is this development?
You know, there's new information that continues to trickle out on this story, and there is a current investigation by the Department of Justice Inspector General on the Trump Justice Department's seizures of Democratic lawmakers' phone data. So I would just hesitate as a journalist to sort of tie the story up in a neat little bow, but the information that is coming out, both in reporting and the emails released by Congress, it really does paint a worrying picture of Trump and his allies using or at least trying to use the Department of Justice, which is supposed to be independent, although presidents from both parties sometimes cross the line. Although I think it's clear that Trump has gone above and beyond in crossing that line, especially from the details coming out in the story of trying to use the DOJ to pursue, as you mentioned, these baseless allegations of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election. In one troubling example, the president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, sending a top justice official a YouTube video of a conspiracy theory involving Italian military satellites being used to steal the election, to which one top justice official in an email called it pure insanity. The other part of this is that the Trump administration may have improperly seized the phone data of Democratic lawmakers, Hill staff, and journalists as part of an aggressive leak investigation. So as you can imagine, Kim, Democrats are outraged. They want to launch hearings and investigations. And Republicans are sort of shrugging this off, that this will just turn into a political circus. But Democrats, you can be sure, are going to pursue this.
Steve, what's your take on this? What can we expect from this information?
I think you're going to find that there's going to be even more hearings in Congress on both the House and the Senate on this. And with the House and the Senate being led by Democrats, any kind of investigation of what happened on January 6th and the events that led up to it, including the president's attempt to use the Justice Department to try to overturn the election, it's going to be seen as partisan. The Republicans are going to use the idea that the Democrats are doing the investigation as a partisan cudgel. And all of that said, it is the Republicans who are not supporting a bipartisan, really non-political, non-governmental commission to investigate what happened on January 6th. So the Republicans are trying to keep any kind of official investigation of what happened, keep that down, keep that quiet, call it partisan as a way to try to ameliorate any kind of political fallout that will happen in the 2022 elections, which are really starting right now as far as campaigning and making decisions as far as who's going to run, who's going to raise money, and what issues they're going to run on.
And we'll just have to keep following these developments as they are brought to light. wanted to move on and get our last couple of topics in. We have good news to share from California, the first state to shut down during the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, the Golden State has reopened this week, though public transportation and healthcare workers will continue to mask up. So will people who need to visit their doctor or go to the hospital for appointments. But still, Shana, most people will say this is good news compared to this time last year.
Oh my gosh, yes. Even here in DC, where most restrictions were lifted last week, you can just see people look so relieved, and bars are packed, restaurants are packed, people aren't wearing masks, and the numbers are very good here in DC, which is why they lifted restrictions. But you can see there's just this sort of sense of relief that things are turning back into normal. Of course, the pandemic is not over. You have this Delta variant coming from India that has some public health experts concerned because it's highly contagious, although it's important to say that not all public health experts agree on this issue. There are different opinions here. I think Scott Gottlieb, who's a really well-respected voice on the pandemic, the former head of the FDA, he's not too concerned because he says that there is evidence that if you have two vaccine shots or the one shot from Johnson & Johnson, you're well protected against any variants that have come out so far. The issue, of course, is that there are some pockets of the United States where people aren't vaccinated. But, you know, some more optimistic public health experts say the most sort of vulnerable population, which is American seniors, the vast majority of them are vaccinated. It would be younger people who are traditionally healthier who might be at risk.
We're still short of President Biden's goal of having 70% of American adults to have at least one shot by the 4th of July, Independence Day. Right now, about 65% of adults have gotten at least one shot. And surprisingly, 24 states, almost half the United States, have vaccination rates of 60% or lower. And that is one of the reasons there's a lot of concern about the various different variants, the Delta variant and specifically, of creating more illness in the United States because not enough people are vaccinated. That's going to be the next challenge, is to get vaccination rates a little bit higher, as well as get children vaccinated in time for schools to reopen in the fall, and hopefully have a winter in which we're not going to have to go back to being indoors and masked and separated.
So it looks like people are easing back into their pre-COVID comfort zone. And in our last few minutes, I wanted to mention the Senate passing a bill to have Juneteenth recognized as a national holiday. And in just a bit of history on Juneteenth, Juneteenth commemorates when the last enslaved African Americans learned they were free. Confederate soldiers surrendered in April 1865, but word didn't reach the last enslaved Black people until June 19th, when Union soldiers brought the news of freedom to Galveston, Texas. So I'll just put this out to both of you, Shana and Steve. Is this not long overdue, especially since many states have been celebrating Juneteenth for years?
It certainly has been long overdue, considering that this first happened in 1865. And it has been traditionally celebrated. Most states have marked it in some way, but it's never been a federal holiday. Now, with both the Senate and the House passing it, it is going to be sent to President Biden to sign into law, make it into a federal holiday. The push really gained steam after the murder of George Floyd by a white police officer and the widespread protests we saw after this. And everyone in the Senate agreed to this. And there were about a dozen Republicans in the House that were against it, but every single Republican senator agreed to it, or at least didn't voice an objection, which is something pretty rare and remarkable to happen in Washington, D.C.
I find that to be the biggest news coming out of the Juneteenth holiday, is that the Senate went ahead and, on a voice vote, full unanimity, which is something that we haven't seen in the country in quite a while, especially with a holiday that does have racial overtones. The fact that the U.S. Senate is able to pass it unanimously gives a little bit of hope that the Juneteenth holiday will be a marker that can endure beyond a lot of the racial politics that we're living through right now.
Well said, both of you. We're going to end the show on that positive note. Thanks to Shana Istulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA executive editor. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.